Good morning, folks. It's time for Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show about political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Join us for a stimulating, thought-provoking discussion. You'll get the facts as we focus on the real challenges facing Arizonans. Good morning, folks. Steve Williamson here. Welcome to Fact-Based Radio. Sitting across from me is a fact. He was dozing off a minute ago. That's actually not a fact. He was pretending to.
Well, that's a fat-based radio if you're talking about
me. Your name, sir, is?
Mike Cosentino. Guy Cosentino. Cosentino, if you want to do the Italian pronunciation. And we have Silent Gary.
Super producer.
Good morning.
Keeps us on track here. All right. But we want to do
something. We want to do a kind of a little bit of a split show, but we want to take on today's Labor Day.
Labor Day.
And we and Gary and Mike particularly are going to go, and I'm going to correct their errors, a history of Labor Day. Why do we have a Labor Day? In fact, why do we have a five-day work week instead of a six-day work week?
Yeah.
And why do we have all these days off? Why do we have a limitation on working like 40 hours a week and then you're supposed to get overtime? Where does all this stuff come? Did it just drop down on America from some UFO?
Oh, because of the kindness. Because of the kindness of corporations. That's why we have those things. Because they care about their workers and they want. No, we don't. We have them because of the labor movement. The most least understood part of history. You could walk up to any college history major, graduate, advanced degrees, and ask them about labor history, and they don't know squat because they didn't study labor history. It is the most ignored history that we have in our country. Forget black history. We're talking labor history is way more ignored than black history.
When I studied American constitutional law, there's almost nothing in the course about the impact of the labor movement on American law and about how labor law got going. It's all about a very famous Supreme Court case. I just took an undergraduate course in it, so it's not like I spent years. But there's it was almost nothing, Gary, about how labor changed America, how it changed the laws of America.
It's what people don't realize, you know, I agree with everything that you guys have said, is that people don't realize that it was the other civil war in the U.S.
Absolutely.
It was
where Americans were killing Americans.
Yeah, it was a bloodbath in many cases. Blair Mountain was the most extreme in West Virginia.
Williamson County in West Virginia, where I think some of my relatives passed through.
Yeah, the Blair Mountain is in Morgan County, West Virginia, but it involved like 10,000 troops. There were millions of rounds fired. The sheriff, who was anti-labor, decided to take on the workers who were striking for better working conditions and better wages, et cetera. And it ended up being a bloodbath.
Labor Day was like when they were celebrating it. It was like back in the day. It was like Martin Luther King holiday. States were accepting it one by one. And then the U.S. military and U.S. marshals killed a bunch of workers during the Pullman strike. Right. And that's what finally pushed Labor Day into a national spotlight. So we have Labor Day as a national holiday because the U.S. government, I don't know, maybe the right-wingers aren't wrong, because the U.S. government, the U.S. military killed people because they wanted better working conditions and higher wages.
Well, the other thing is that, we talked a lot about national monuments, but President Obama, who supposedly is a liberal guy, made the Pullman facility. Their sort of industrial town that Pullman created a national monument. Oh, it's an interesting old building. It's a complex thing. I see why he did it. It's not political left or right. But Pullman cut wages to his people by like 2/3. He raised their rents. He ran off anybody who did anything. He had a company store, and his place gets to be a national monument.
That was one of the company store was one of the most insidious parts. It was another form of slavery. Because they would hire people, give them a job at an incredibly low rate, work them 7 days a week, you know, 12 to 14, 15 hours a day. And then they would give them subsidized housing often, and then have them buy everything at the company store.
Sure, we all know that story. We had that right here, Clarkdale, W.A. Right. Clark. He did exactly that in Jerome and in Clarkdale, and the result is the Jerome Historical Society and other people were able to buy properties in the 50s and 60s for the grocery bill. In other words, they would get deed to the property because they paid off their $100 or $200 grocery bill left at the company store.
Clarkdale was originally a company town. It still has that structure. If you go over and do a tour of Clarkdale, all the streets were, the lower Clarkdale was for the miners, upper Clarkdale was for the managers.
Yeah,
they had a separate discriminatory area for Chinese, a separate
Ban Shell in the middle of the park was not put there for the workers in the mines at Jerome. It was put there for the management that lived around the park in Clarkdale. The point I want to make with all this vitriol, you know, is besides the labor movement, passion about an issue that's frankly, folks, just not
covered in our history books. The whole labor study, because it's controversial, has kind of been written out of our history books, right, Mike?
Yes. The short answer is yes. Now, we do have a wider variety of history books in 2015. We have Howard Zinn saw this, the Zinn Project, and he started writing history books, at least he left the legacy.
Of course, most Arizona schools can't afford those.
Right, new book. Yeah, they're still looking. They rely on the internet, and God knows everything on the internet's true.
I saw something true on the internet just yesterday.
My final point, or at least the point I'm trying to get to, is organizing is so powerful that Gary's wonderful notes here talked about. 24% of the jobs out there are retail sales, and only 3% of them are organized. Folks, if you got a retail job, if you got a service industry job, and you never have to be afraid of a boss, you never have to be afraid of unfair treatment if you organize. When I see the way people are treated, when I see the way jobs are handed out, and the favoritism and the ugliness on the job and the stress that workers endure because they accepted an $8 or $9 an hour job in a hotel in some places or in a restaurant. Friends, please organize. You don't have to go. Did labor unions do bad things? Yeah. Did they go too far in some cases? Yes. We can talk about that if you want.
Yeah. The union, one of the unions that I was a member of in New York City was under federal receivership. And there were large guys sitting around with a broken arm. And they had a nice, respectable guy as the new president of it.
Right.
It did us a lot of good.
That's right.
It's a famously,
and it's worth.
Can I say the word mafia? As if mafia controlled
the
union
mafia
for a long time.
We can go over the words that you can say in a minute.
We're working in this new hotel, and they're working us way over the amount of time they're paying for. So we're working 10 hours, and they're paying us for 7 hours. We're working 12 hours. And it built up till the company owed us thousands of dollars. And we looked around, and we said, where's the union? Because this is New York City. Where's the union? And the union had to deal with new hotels that they don't come in for 6 months,
right,
so that the hotel can get rid of the bad guys. I don't really have so much of a problem for that, but they owed me a lot of money, you know,
right,
and they owed a lot of us a lot of money, and they were pushing us to do a lot of unpaid work. So, we went and threatened the union. We said, well, you know, if you guys don't come in and organize real quick, we're going to get in, I think it was Local 6 out of New Haven, which are really a bunch of tough characters, and we're going to bring them in. But what happened when the union came in was when we got paid for everything.
There you go.
They got me about $1,000 of my back pay back. Even a union had been corrupt that the feds were now keeping an eye on delivered a lot of stuff for us.
That's right.
In terms of they no longer would keep the restaurant open extraordinarily late hours because they had to pay the cooks and everybody had to be paid if they worked overtime. It was transformative.
Take a chance, folks. That's all I'm saying. Take a chance. Join the union. Believe me, you'll be better off.
Now the other
did they do bad things once in a while? Yeah. Did they defend incompetence once in a while? Yeah. Should they have? No, they shouldn't. And it's the same, message to you. If you're an incompetent dishwasher, if you're an incompetent teacher, then you should not be working and the union shouldn't be defending you. But if you're doing your job and you are capable, then you should be working without fear.
There's a lot of stereotyping about this. One of the managers came to me and said, "Steve, you know, we'd like to get rid of this guy." And he said, "Do you think the union would have any problem with us getting rid of him?" And I said, "No, I'm afraid to leave him on my cash register alone. I'd like him out of here as much as you did." So they fired him. The union went into negotiation and asked him for a couple of weeks of pay or something, and it was resolved. Another guy stole something. He got caught. Nothing the union can do. So all these things are exaggerated. I will say, Mike, if you're unionizing, it's best to win, because we were unionizing the largest restaurant corporation in the United States. It had the franchise for the restaurants at the Metropolitan Opera. We were kind of being abused by our boss. He wasn't a bad human being, but he was a bad, bad boss. And so we organized. And again, we had to call in a union from out of New York, because the unions in New York were slow to come in. We had a vote. The labor relations people were all over the place. And we had a secret ballot. The company went around and told all the Hispanic guys that if the union got in, they would never become bartenders. They would always have to be busboys, threatened with examining their papers, because everybody had papers. They're not talking about people who are visibly illegal or undocumented folks. Everybody's documented and stuff.
Right.
Threatened them. We lost by one vote, Mike. We lost by a single vote.
Yeah.
Within 6 months, every one of us who was for the union was fired.
Yeah.
So if you're going to do this, I will say that, and I know Mike's real idealistic, but if you're going to do this, don't lose. Because once you lose,
the labor relations board, we got it. They leave, and you're
at the mercy of the employer.
We got it. Mike's not idealistic. Even the threat of a union in 2015.
You're not idealistic?
No, I'm not. Even the threat of a union will improve your conditions. You understand? Just talking about a union, just hanging out, even a union in town, even a union in north in the area will improve your conditions. That's the beauty of unions, that you don't have to belong to one or join one to enjoy the benefits of one.
This is exactly how it works. In New York, there was one luxury hotel that was non-unionized, and I think it was the Hyatt. And the reason it was non-unionized, the way they got around being non-unionized, was that they paid people there more than the union was able to negotiate.
There you go.
So the union actually raised their wages. They were actually riding on union benefits and that's why their wages were high. And that's just what Mike's talking about. In other words, it sets off a kind of, what would you call it, kind of a chain reaction of increased wages.
Most people in the U.S. actually benefit from unions, whether you're a member or not. I've never been a member of a union. I never had an opportunity because I was always in management. But
And we let you in the door anyway.
Right. But the fact is that
I let him partly in the door.
That it was labor unions that got us the 40-hour work week. It was labor unions that focused on holidays and working conditions and things like that. And all of us have benefited. And I think one of the real ironies is, you know, Labor Day has become just another 3-day holiday. Like, you know, no more important than all of the Hallmark holidays, you know, Father's Day, et cetera, you know, designed to sell greeting cards. But
the picnics and parades are gone. In my hometown, they still had some when I was very young, and they still had a big city picnic. The businesses had picnics. Everything on Labor Day, it was a big, you know, flags and speeches and ice cream, and you get the idea.
It's become a retail holiday. It's the second biggest retail day outside of Black Friday for Christmas.
After Thanksgiving.
Yeah, which as Mike pointed out, you know, 24% of our population of our workers are in retail. So the irony is that most of the people in retail are working today.
That's it. Most of the people that there for are working.
On the day that was designed to celebrate their...
There you go. Well, for whatever reason, we look down on labor. I don't get it. We used to celebrate labor. We look down on labor. People like... the Bush administration, others, especially
Reagan.
In politics, they somehow being a worker from being an exalted thing has become a shameful thing. And I want there's 168 hours in a week. You work 40 of them. You sleep 50 of them. The rest are yours. Thanks. Thank you. Unions. That's not such a bad deal compared to some parts of the world.
The attitudes towards I think you have a great point. The attitudes towards labor have turned full circle since the 50s and 60s, which all of the conservatives seem to celebrate and wish we would go back to. But in those days, people really admired people who worked, especially people who were craftsmen. And now the admiration, those people are kind of looked down on, and the admiration is for people like Mitt Romney who exploit our laws to, you know, to enrich themselves through manipulation and tax avoidance.
Yeah, when did the hedge fund manager and the private equity partners become these are the criminals of American society?
They used to be.
I had a friend in New York who was involved in this, and what she said was, and I think it's absolutely true, the closer you are to the stream of money, the easier it is to make money, the less you have to do. And hedge fund managers, exactly, they're money manipulators. They're not building anything. You mentioned Trump, but at least Trump built buildings, right? Romney didn't do anything.
with a lot of mafia help.
Well, yeah.
He built bank accounts. Well, my dad said this. I mean, you know, we talked about, before the show, we were talking about family business, raising an Italian family. But he said, you'll never get rich working for a living. And I have to admit, it took me most of my adult childhood to figure out what he meant by that. As usual, by the way, I had no idea what he was talking about. You'll never get rich working for a living. This is a man who worked every day of his life in a family business, expected me to do the same and not leave home and stay there. But the point is, money makes money. The point is, other people's labor is how you get rich. You don't get rich by going out to work yourself.
That's right. Now, in other words, if you had a company, folks, and you split the money evenly, then there would be no money, you know, and I don't mean literally evenly, but if you distributed the money very, very, very fairly, then there would be no huge benefit to being the owner. I mean, it would be a much smaller benefit, and you can see that in foreign countries, particularly in Europe. But the thing is that you have to pay people less than what you're going to do end up with the money, and anything you can scoop off the top. So when you have a labor union, you have people who say, well, we want a part of this money. We want a larger share of the money that the corporation is making. And we want it to go to everybody who here. And so it spreads out the money to a lot of people. That stimulates the economy because people who work for a living didn't go and spend money on the things. They help the stores and so forth and so on. But that's the structure of corporations now, is with when they're completely free of any kind of union balancing, any kind of, what was it, Galbraith, the economist, called it, countervailing forces. In other words, there's just capital, there's no labor, organized labor, then capital gets a bigger and bigger and bigger share of all the profits, which if you're, you know, Mitt Romney type, that's a good thing.
Right.
But for the rest of us, wages have been stagnated for a decade at least.
At least.
Yeah.
That's always been the battle is, and why labor unions were created was that, capital took it, looked at, workers as resources and, to have money made off of them. And, prior to labor unions, the manufacturers took advantage of immigrants, the Irish, the Italians, and so on, and paid them. They had very little power, political clout, so they were paid much less. And so they basically built their industries off of the backs of underpaid immigrants. We see the same thing going on today, only it's changed. Our large corporations, the multinationals, have shipped jobs offshore to the lowest paying countries on the planet, where people will work without benefits, work long hours, work in sweatshops.
Hazardous conditions. The fires in Bangladesh killed a lot of people. The explosions in China. That's not having environmental regulations to protect workers.
It's the exact same thing that went on in the U.S., only they've just moved it offshore, so it's kind of out of sight, out of mind, as far as most Americans are concerned.
Patrick, go ahead. I'm sorry.
But it's, I just wanted to finish, is that all of this, labor unions actually, worked against those kinds of conditions, but now with, the things have shifted and the manufacturers have sent the labor, the traditional labor union jobs offshore to avoid them.
Go ahead, Mike.
I'm just saying, power has never given up anything without a struggle.
True.
Never has and never will. So I don't. It's places like employee-owned businesses like Costco and a few others, because they're employee-owned, maybe. You certainly have a more equitable. Once again, you got to show up. You got to do the work.
You got to do the job.
You got to learn the job. We're not talking about a replacement.
If you're in a union and you're a union guy and you do not want incompetent people. You don't, particularly in the hotel restaurant business. You don't want anybody who steals money. You don't want anybody who doesn't show up, because if they don't show up, you have to work for them.
Right.
So it's not the stereotype of all these union regulations and stuff really false.
And it is.
I don't think that our union had any bad regulations. If we wanted to get paid for the hours that we worked and they weren't doing it. And that's why they ended up with a union a few months earlier than they would have otherwise.
Don't you find it interesting that people so readily focus on the corruption of union leadership,
right,
and on the money that they take, yet they never focus on the corruption of large corporations? So some of our most corrupt people in the U.S. work for large corporations. They make millions of dollars a year and then send the money offshore so they don't have to pay taxes on it. These are people that would have been and should be put in prison for tax evasion.
They have a slew of lawyers, and I was reading some research on this, and the very wealthy, we may go to H&R Block or somebody, and we may have an accountant or somebody, a tax preparer who does our taxes and tries to find us tax cuts. These guys have a slew of tax lawyers, of all kinds of people, and they actually are rewriting the regulations so that they don't have to pay any taxes. Plus, look, it's easy to take on a union. Part of that is right-wing politics, but part of it is just easy compared to taking on these giant corporations. These people have millions of dollars. They have a lot of political clout. You're taking, if you step on the oligarchy's toes, they're going to get mad at you.
One of the ironies, I think, is, we heard when the Affordable Care Act was written that it's 2,000 pages. It's just an insanely long law. which actually it's not any longer than most laws. But the point is that the reason it is so long and most laws are so long is as soon as it's put on paper, we have corporate lawyers across the country looking for loopholes in which they can exploit to make large sums of money.
Exactly. I'm going to leave you with three words, folks. We're going to reduce it to simple. Organize. Maybe one word. But
It's three syllables.
maybe one word. But organization can help you so much. It's a good thing.
But Mike, isn't it scary? You're working for a company, you know. The union comes around and says, would you like to join? Management's going to be watching for this kind of thing. And if you don't have the feds looking over their shoulder and making sure they can't fire you for just talking to the union, you know, you can end up with a problem.
That's the other word I was looking for, collective bargaining. It's almost here in 2015. Nobody even knows what it means. But collective bargaining laws have all been run out of most states, but it really was important. And binding arbitration, when you go to a third party, that both sides will be bound by the decision. Each side presents their case. You have very often a retired judge or a labor attorney who makes the decision. They listen to management, they listen to the employees, and they make a decision. And they are bound by that decision. Most companies, most corporations want no part of that. They want no part of collective bargaining because they know that organized workers, they can't fight them. They can't win. Now, do you need to organize at Google where the staff massage person is running around? Excuse me, the half a dozen staff massage people are running around giving people massages at their desk? Probably not. Where you have, you know, meditation period, you know, Google doesn't need to organize unless, I don't know, each one of them wants a yacht.
Amazon, on the other hand, sounds like they could benefit from it. Mm-hmm. You know, one of the really sad things I think that's going on is just, you know, to kind of sum up the whole union thing is that the minimum wage has become a huge battle. It's been determined that the living wage is $15 an hour. Just the ability to make a living without relying on government assistance is roughly $15 an hour across the country.
Yep. So when they're not paying $15, then really taxpayers through the government are subsidizing them because they don't have enough money to buy the essentials, right?
And the minimum wage is half that. And so we have this big, you know, dialogue going on across the country. And as always, the owners are saying, well, we can't afford to pay a living wage. Well, I submit, if you can't afford to pay a living wage, you can't afford to be in business. It's if you can't afford to pay your workers what they're worth, then you have no business to begin with.
Obama's pushing $10.10 an hour, $10.10.
It's still going to be less than a living wage.
Well, I understand, but it does make people's lot a little better.
And today, by the way, he's signing an executive order that mandates federal contractors give paid sick leave. Imagine that. In this day and age, we have federal contractors that weren't paying their employees sick leave.
He's done quite a bit of things for people who work for federal contractors.
1 hour for every 30 hours, by the way.
They've been extending stuff. What I see, and what I think is kind of interesting, see what you guys think, is that I was reading an article, and it said that, you know, in a lot of industrial countries, there's a huge amount of leave. You have a kid, your mom takes off, so forth and so on, gets paid, that fathers can take off, so forth and so on. There's lots of paid leave for lots of different reasons. And what they're saying about the United States is that people are afraid to actually take whatever leave is available. They're afraid. We have a culture here where you don't take the amount of time off you even have. You accumulate vacation time. You don't take it off. Everyone is afraid. There's this fear thing where, I mean, Europeans are not afraid to go off for 6 weeks in on a vacation. Americans are afraid for their jobs if they leave them even for a short time. They don't take advantage of even the existing laws because they're afraid that what, they'll be fired or demoted their job will be eliminated.
The displeasure of the boss. Don't forget, there's lots of things that happen on the job besides getting fired.
Or just not being able to advance. Somebody else who doesn't take the leave gets, the promotion and you don't. That was always one of my issues.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's what happened. I think you're right. The emphasis is not so much on firing because it would be illegal and you could, put in a protest. But, I think the thing is, and I don't know how we got this way, is that without union protection, so once you're in the union, once I was in the union, they couldn't fire me for no reason anymore.
They just couldn't do it. Yeah, unions protect due process.
Yeah, they protect due process. Even guys who were guilty got some due process. It just didn't save them. So if you stole caviar, like one guy got caught with where I worked, you're gone. And a union can't help you. The union will stand up for you, but you're going to lose. It's that kind of a thing. It's like having a lawyer when you've been caught red-handed. They'll make the best case they can for you, but you're gone. So this notion that this widespread notion that unions breed corruption just because people are protected from firing and removal, is not true. Now, there's a lot of federal law that keeps people, that protects people, which is like you can't be discriminated against because you're a woman, and you can't be discriminated against because you're a minority, and so forth and so on. Disability, because you have a disability, if it doesn't affect the job, you can't just not hire you or fire you because of it. So there's a lot of things that protect workers that come really from federal law. Mostly, most of the protections that you have, most of the limitations on how much you can be asked to work, everything comes from a federal law that was developed in response to industrial conflict in the late 19th century and 20th century. It comes from conflict, and it's actually the laws were set to resolve conflicts and to prevent further conflicts and to stabilize the situation. So that the violence between union and management fades and fades and fades, and you get into a much more collaborative process.
If you're a teacher, please join a union. If you're a nurse, please join a union. If you're a service worker, please join your union. Those are the three biggest unions that I know of in the United States right now that are the most active and have the most impact for their workers. That's a lot of folks. Get busy.
Before we get off
what are we supposed to be talking about today?
I just wanted to point out there's a couple of things you might not consider for that labor unions have accomplished. The civil rights movement. A lot of the financing for the civil rights movement came from the labor unions.
The strategy?
Particularly the UAW.
A lot of the money that supported the civil rights
movement. I've got a note. The Screen Actors Guild has, people think of actors as these, multimillion, and a few of them are, many of them are. But the rest of the people that labor for the entertainment industry are not rich. The Screen Actors Guild has a very strong union and effective union.
And ironically, one of the biggest union busters, maybe the biggest union buster in history, was Ronald Reagan. And he was a former president of the Screen Actors
Guild. Let's talk about that, because it's his breaking of the air traffic controllers that is kind of a tipping point with the breaking of unions.
Yeah,
Gary?
He absolutely attacked unions. PATCO was the union for the air traffic controllers. they were having problems, you know, prior to Reagan being elected. So Reagan met with them and exchanged, you know, communications with them, promising that he would help them because they were working, they were understaffed and overstressed. And so he promised he would help them. There's some documentation on that. And then as soon as he got in power, you know, he ignored them. And so they went on strike. And then he busted the union. He literally invoked the Taft-Hartley Act, saying they were a critical union
Taft-Hartley
workforce.
You meant exactly what, Gary? What is the rule on Taft-Hartley?
It put restrictions on labor unions if they were considered if the workers were considered essential workers to the government. Or you know to the U.S. as a whole, it put great restrictions on their ability to strike or negotiate, and so basically he broke the PACO union. One of my neighbors at the time was a member of the union. He was unemployed for years trying to find another job. Had to go back to school and reeducate himself. Became an airline pilot. Actually ended up doing better, but he was, we had long conversations at the time that the conditions that they were working under prior to their being dismissed were, you know, I mean, they knew that an accident, major accidents were going to happen if nothing changed.
And you get these situations, you mentioned airline pilots, had a friend who retired, right before basically all the benefits and stuff got cut to airline pilots and the amount of money. So it's that situation where the older guys are essentially neutralized by getting decent wages and the new people get much less and much less benefit. And so he just, you know, happened to get under the umbrella before the umbrella got closed up because it was going to rain.
Other things I'd like to point out that I think is particularly appropriate for Arizona and in the Southwest is the United Farm Workers. One of the reasons I got into journalism was because of a documentary done by Edward R. Murrow on the plight of migrant workers. And it, you know, that went on. I mean, these poor people, you know, worked for next to nothing under horrible conditions, lived in shanties. Were taken advantage of because they were immigrants. You know, they were not American citizens. And so Cesar Chavez organized the United Farm Workers that brought some sanity to that. It's still horrible. You know, they're still poorly paid. American
but
citizens
did get better, right?
Yeah, here. But American citizens, you know, they've tried over and over again to give unemployed Americans a chance to take these jobs. Some of them have tried, and all of them have failed. They've tried giving the jobs to prisoners, and they've failed at it because it's
Listen,
too hard
picking,
to work.
Picking lemons for a living is a real tough gig.
Yeah.
And when
and
I was in college,
or whatever.
People would, you know, the students would go do it for a while and pick up enough. Because in those days, we didn't have a lot of money. You would go and do it for a while and pick up some money. But nobody stayed doing it. I mean, it's really awful. It's really hard. And the guys who are doing it are 10 times as good as you at picking lemons. You're usually paid by the box of lemons that you do. So
it's piecework.
It's piecework, yeah.
No, the farm worker, I want to talk about, I've said it on the show before, that Arizona, as they say, well, it's a right-to-work state. You can't be talking. Yeah, you can. You can organize in a right-to-work state.
Tell folks what a right-to-work actually
means. Every state
means.
Is a right-to-work state. I mean, this is America. Every state is a right-to-work state. It just means that there is no collective bargaining law, number one. And it means that don't have to join a union. You can't have a closed shop. This radio station exists. We don't have to join a union to, and they can't keep you out. because you won't join the union.
So what happens with
right to work?
Right to work is you have a business, the union organizes it, the union gets everybody good wages. You don't have to join the union.
That's right.
You don't have to pay any dues.
I see. Well, the note is going to management as usual here.
Yeah. And management says can be fired without cause.
There you go. Yeah. That's true.
One of the side effects of the old Confederacy is the whole right to work thing. The right to work states are almost exclusively, it's growing. Unfortunately, Wisconsin just became one thanks to Scott Walker. But it was primarily through the South because there was animosity towards labor and organized labor. But it really was the old Confederacy that after World War II, when labor unions really took off, it was a reaction to that, that the South instituted right to work states. That was when in the 70s, the manufacturers started moving their first step to offshoring jobs was to move them to the South where there were no labor unions and no ability to organize. Then they moved them, when that didn't work, they moved the jobs to Mexico because they wanted, cheaper labor and less benefits. Then they moved them to China and Vietnam and Pakistan and Sri Lanka and what have you.
There's a very positive side to capitalism, and there's a very shadow side to it. And one of them, I think, is what Gary is talking about here. The other thing is, when we tried to organize and we lost the vote, basically the feds abandoned us. And within 6 months, they had fired everybody who had been in the union. And they always came up with a reason. They had lawyers and professional union busters on site against a bunch of bartenders and barbacks and waiters and waitresses. We didn't have much of a chance. So one day I was walking on the street and I ran into a woman that I worked with, and she said, "Well, I'm the last one." She said, I don't remember, 6 or 8 months. He said, "They finally got me. Everybody else who voted for the union's gone. They knew who we were." So, protections are not complete, but the federal government does protect you if you organize. If you file to organize a union in a place, the feds are going to watch over it. They're not going to be able to gratuitously fire you for joining the union.
Unless you're Walmart.
Right now, we want to get some of our things in for our sponsors. Democrats of the Red Rocks are back. It's fall. They're back to their meeting schedule. Interesting meeting. Discussion on water quality and availability in the Verde Valley. They got a speaker, Tally Siegel, from the Oak Creek Watershed Council.
We're going to try to do an interview with her and have him. I don't even know.
It's at the Old Sedona Bar and Grill, and it'll be 8 a.m. on the 17th, September 17th. We have DOOR's annual picnic, that we're calling it the annual picnic and eco expo. Up there at the Living Springs Camp near the Fish Hat.
Who cooks the hamburgers there?
I cook the hot dogs. We cook the food. We cook Boca burgers. We cook hot dogs.
What are Boca
healthy
burgers?
Healthy hot dogs. No rat feces in our hot dogs, by the way.
Veggie burgers.
Yeah, veggie burgers.
Veggie burgers.
We have them.
It's worth going for the food and the location itself.
There's music. There's auctions.
Great
it's,
location.
It's a great, fun
please,
time.
At the Living Springs Camp in Oak Creek Canyon. This is the DOOR annual picnic and eco expo. My new organization, the Verde River Valley Nature Organization, will be there. These are the people that bring you the Bird Festival and Verde River Days and those kinds.
The focus of the picnic is all the different environmental organizations.
And I will be auctioning pies, I hear. And if you're really good, I will be auctioning wine.
There are great pies.
We will get our auctioneer par excellento, namely Jim Ledbetter, to auction the expensive wines, while Sandy Moriarty and the mayor of Sedona and me and I, we will auction the cheap wines. Please get this this recording on VVID.org. VVID has all our podcasts, including this show, whenever we get around to posting it. We'll be right back.
You've been listening to Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show focusing on the political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Catch us every Monday morning after the 8 o'clock news, right here on AM 780 KAZM. It's beautiful out there, folks. Have a great day.